the applicant, Your Honor, David Eason, appearing for...
Yes, speak up.
Yes, Your Honor. David Eason, appearing on behalf of the appellants, Brooke and Mary Jo Banbury, in cases 1614 and 1615. With the court's leave, we have only two sides here, and I understand we have an hour scheduled. We would prefer, again, with the court's leave, to make very few comments.
Let me stop you just a minute. Could you go ahead and start the clock? Go ahead.
Your Honor, we would prefer to make very few comments about case 1615. We essentially would prefer to rest on our briefs in that case and use most of our time allotted, which I understand to be 30 minutes, on case 1614 with the court's leave. There are three issues in case...
So if you were asking, that's fine.
Okay. There are three issues, and I don't know whether it's customary with this division to reserve time at this point, but I would like to reserve at least 15 minutes of my time at this point. There are three issues in case 1614 that we think the court should focus on that we think are critical to the disposition of the issues. The first issue is what, under the terms of the company, and by the company I mean DocuVault, what are the terms of its amended and restated operating agreement are Colorado gross receipts? That's a textual interpretation of the agreement. What under the terms of the agreement constitutes a default such that when it occurs, the interests of my clients, the Banburys, are automatically converted from Class B interests to Class A interests under the agreement? And what was the evidence that suggested default before the court below? And finally, did the court correctly assess and determine the question of waiver with respect to the default? And I will address those questions in that order.
Yes, let me just understand the interrelationship. Your issue two is really, your Colorado gross receipts issue is really related to the issue of was there a default, was there not?
That's correct. The definition and understanding of Colorado gross receipts in the agreement is integral to the understanding of what a default is under the agreement. That is where we think the analysis begins, because until that question is settled, it's difficult to address the question of what a default is and whether the evidence below indicated a genuine issue of material fact as to whether one in fact occurred.
And well, apart from the Colorado gross receipts issue, I understand that you have a default claim based on, is it 06? You have allegedly three consecutive months of, let's say, inadvertent underpayment that nobody knew about at the time?
That's correct, Your Honor. And even by the company's admission, that default involved Colorado gross receipts. So one can, with that exception, look at default without having to really consider the definition of Colorado gross receipts. The company, by its admission, did not pay for 3 months the required 4% due and owing of Colorado receipts, Colorado gross receipts, for 3 months during 2006. We believe the court recognized that and recognized that that was a default by underpayment of the 4% that was due. What we believe the court erred in doing was in assessing the effect of that underpayment. The court erred in two ways. First, the court did not consider the 5% charge provision in Section 4.1 of the amended and restated operating agreement. It therefore did not add to the amounts by which the Banburys had been underpaid, the 5% of what should have been paid as required under the agreement, which certainly magnifies the dollar amount of the default.
The other party is in effect saying, yes, we underpaid, but it was only $200 or $300 over a period of so many months, and we paid them an extraordinarily large amount we'd properly done. Is that correct?
The other side is arguing a de minimis approach,
yeah,
to a certain extent.
Why is that inappropriate?
It's inappropriate because there's no de minimis exception in the agreement with respect to the contract does not allow of any such exception. What the contract does allow is 3 months. The company has 3 months to get it right. And if they don't get it right for those three consecutive months, they're in default.
They made timely payments of those 3 months, but not the proper amount.
That's correct. The payments were on time, but they were low.
Yeah.
And they were low not only because they did not properly calculate and pay on Colorado gross receipts for the month. They were low because they didn't add the 5% at that point. And then finally, the court's last error, they didn't apply going back to the first month for which distributions were owed and not paid as the agreement requires. So what you have is a cumulative rolling default going forward. And if you look at the record, if you look at the spreadsheet, volume 1, pages 3090 to 3092, and you simply do the arithmetic, you find that there is a default beginning in April of 2006 that continues each month to the end of 2006. And that's the case even if you take the overpayments that are reflected in the first 3 months of 2006, as well as the overpayments reflected in September and October of 2006.
All of this, in the heart of this dispute, what are Colorado gross receipts?
Well, with respect to this default, the answer is no, because even the company, everybody agrees that this concerns Colorado gross receipts. Where the dispute starts with Colorado gross receipts concerns the so-called out-of-state revenue.
We'll move into that, and I understand that's your issue one, and we're kind of jumped ahead to issue two. But let's stick with the 06, and let me get your answer to this hypothetical. April of 06, inadvertently, nobody knows at the time, the parents are underpaid $1,000, right? 1 month underpayment. Every payment after that, nobody knows about it, but in May, they're paid correctly, but for making up the 1,000 with their alleged 5%. That 1 month underpayment of $1,000, in your view, is a status-altering event that nobody knew about, but two to three years later, you say, oops, we found out a $1,000 bookkeeping error never made up, and therefore you had not just three consecutive months, but 24 consecutive months of underpayments. Is that your theory?
That's the way the agreement reads, Your Honor.
Is that a result that strikes you as possibly absurd?
No, it doesn't strike me as absurd.
No.
Because the company A is required in the operating agreement to use cash accounting. Now, it turns out that it didn't, but if it had, there's no problem in tracking cash receipts with cash accounting. Number two, they have 3 months to get it right. They have 3 months to look back and look at each month and make a determination. Number three, it's not provided for in the agreement, but common sense tells you that the company can go to the B members, provide its accounting, get their input, and see whether there's any disagreement. They don't have to refuse or fail to communicate with the B members. They can do that. Number four, the company, in case of any doubt, can hedge. It can say, look, we may be a little bit off here, so let's overpay a little bit. What the heck? It'll make sure that we don't default. And then finally, I think this is critical. There is no drastic consequence to conversion here. None. The Banburys go from being B members to being A members. That's it.
As it turns out, that's a good thing for the Banburys. It was a lucrative sale, and the company did well. It's better to be an A member in 08 because the company did well.
Absolutely.
But it could be the opposite, couldn't it? I mean, it could have been the company could have been struggling, and the Banburys were getting 4% of gross receipts.
Right.
There were no profits to the company, and all of a sudden, in 08, they said, oops, we underpaid you in 06 for 1 month for $1,000. Unbeknownst to everybody, you are now A members, and the Banburys might be saying, we don't want to be A members. B members looks better now.
We certainly recognize that door swings both ways, Your Honor. It was a risk that everybody took. That was the deal that was struck. There is no real effect on the company from conversion. In fact, the company does better. It doesn't have to make the B payments. It's not a
serious. Who drafted the amended and restated operating agreement?
To the best of my knowledge, and this is what I think the record reflects, it was counsel for the company. Counsel for the company drafted the agreement.
Which company?
Moy White. Docuval. Docuval's attorneys drafted the agreement with input from Bowen Banbury and some limited input from Brooke Banbury. But to get back to this point of this is the argument that's being made for why there has to be some de minimis exception, there has to be some I didn't know exception, there has to be some inadvertent error exception. The point is, the conversion is not a drastic consequence. In fact, it could be good for the company, and it could be bad for the members. It could be bad for the company and good for the members.
It could be drastically good or drastically bad for both sides. So I think it can be pretty drastic.
Those risks are equal all around,
okay.
And that is why you need to have a bright line test.
But I'm not persuaded by your argument that it's not a drastic remedy. I mean, you're fighting here because it is such a drastic remedy. It would be a pretty big... what are the consequences to the parents? Have you done the back-of-the-envelope calculations or front-of-the-envelope? If they're A-members now...
The consequences to the Banburys are approximately $5 million.
That's pretty drastic.
That is a big consequence. I don't know that it's drastic in the sense that if the contract is not enforced, or if the contract is read in a certain way, they don't get that money. If the contract is interpreted according to what we believe its plain language is, with no exception for de minimis, mistake, error, etc., then they should get their money. The question is, how does it affect the company? It's the company's operating agreement. And one cannot say in any particular circumstance that the consequence to the company or to any members would necessarily be drastic. For example, if the Banburys convert, Bowen Banbury is no longer allowed to redeem or retire their interests. When he can't retire their interests, it means he can't use the company's money to buy their interests and make them his interests. That's obviously a good thing for the other members. Now, so there are multiple permutations of what can happen here. And our point simply is when things are that uncertain in terms of how it works and whose ox gets gored at any particular time, then the agreement should be enforced as written with a bright line test. That is the correct result.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Chris. For you, Your Honor.
Well, once we get past this de minimis argument, let's get to the Colorado gross receipts argument, which you're saying is what?
What the Banburys are saying is that under the terms of the operating agreement, A, all company cash receipts are, by definition, Colorado receipts. There is no other way to read the operating agreement. Proof of that is that the distributions to the members are made out of net cash from operations, which are cash receipts from Colorado operations. The agreement contains no provision anywhere which says what you do with cash receipts that are not Colorado receipts, because it doesn't ever admit of the possibility that there can be non-Colorado receipts, number one. Number two, and it's basically tied to number one, this distinction that the court and the other parties have tried to draw between operations conducted in Colorado and work physically performed somewhere simply doesn't hold up, either under the plain language of the agreement, operations conducted being functions led or guided, as opposed to work performed, which is obviously hands-on, so to speak, boots on the ground. And it necessarily assumes that the company can have receipts that are not Colorado receipts. The reason why this distinction was created was very simple. The record shows that the company did, without violation of the operating agreement, enter into contracts with out-of-state contractors through its subsidiaries. Now, when the company did that, its revenues were derived from those contracts, and they had to be company revenues. And unless it was admitted or contended that that was a violation of the operating agreement, and nobody admitted or contended that in proceedings below, the court never found that in proceedings below, then the only way to distinguish those revenues and keep them out of the category of Colorado gross receipts is to say that they're non-Colorado receipts. They're company revenues, but they're non-Colorado receipts. Therefore, the 4% doesn't have to be paid on them. And that runs you back into the structure of the operating agreement and the definitions under which that's simply not possible.
The your position basically is, as I understand it from the briefs, is that the mere fact that there were employees in Colorado who wrote the checks and entered into the agreements and supervised this work done out of state, that gives them, it's also part of the Colorado receipts. Is that correct?
Our position is that the record's clear that, but for the company's presence in Colorado, its existence and facilities in Colorado, and its customers in Colorado, those contracts never would have existed. Now, on summary judgment, I think we can all agree, factual assessments of causation should not occur. But if we're going to get into the facts about causation, then at least we can say that the record fairly reflects that those agreements would not have existed without the company's Colorado existence, its Colorado personnel, its Colorado facilities, and most importantly, its Colorado customers. The out-of-state services provided by subcontractors were provided to Colorado customers who had out-of-state needs. So we don't view the company's contribution to those contracts as by any means minimal, and I hate to raise the de minimis thing again, but that's again what we get back to when the court below analyzes it, that there is this minimal contribution by the company that shouldn't be considered. That's not true factually, and we don't believe is true in any rational interpretation of the operating agreement.
You wanted to reserve about 15 minutes for rebuttal. You're right about 15 now.
Let me ask you one other question, Mr. Easton. Let's get to the question of Class A membership.
You could keep the time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You want to say something about that now? Or you want to reserve that?
Well, if there's a failure to pay 4% on Colorado gross receipts, and we showed three failures, the 2006...
Let's talk about Class A, Class B membership.
Yes.
Which is it?
The Banburys are Class A members. There was a default. The default led to automatic conversion. And while there may be a tribal issue on waiver, we don't think there's a summary judgment issue on waiver for the reasons we've articulated.
Just one quick follow-up to set the stage for your opposing counsel. You also have an alternative contention that if you're a Class B members, even if it's a matter of law, you remain Class B, you're underpaid, you're entitled to more than the $4 million?
Our contention there is that we are Class B. We could not possibly have been redeemed, you know, for all the reasons described in the brief, and we are therefore entitled to share in the proceeds of liquidation in accordance with our capital accounts. That's where you get into the gain provision. You add to the capital account, you determine the capital accounts, and you determine percentages based on that.
Now, is a question of fact about what your capital account was? Is that dependent on the loans? Is that part of the capital account? Or where, how does that explain to me that loan versus capital account argument?
Well, the record is clear that during the history of the company, at least in the earlier years, the Banburys contributed approximately $1 million to the company. The record is also clear that at the time of the proceedings, and starting with the TRO in this case, Brooke Banbury's capital was stated at $332,000. Mary Jo Banbury had zero. So we have a question as to whether the capital was properly computed, and B, if not, what it should be, and C, based on that result, what should be treated as an advance. The advances were never repaid, and one cannot compute the capital account if there be members adding the $4 million to whatever they start with until you know what that capital account is. That was the purpose of the accounting phase of the case, which we never got to.
And so basically, if this court were to determine that there was a Class B membership, that all what you're saying is that you're entitled to more than the $4 million, it's $4 million plus the capital account, and you were not given an opportunity to present evidence on that issue.
That's correct. We're also entitled to assert claims of injury as members of the company. That's what the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act claims were about. That's what the unjust enrichment claims were about. This was largely an attempt to recover assets to add to the company.
Oh, it's fraudulent in this case.
Well, I hesitate to go into detail, Your Honor, but the bottom line is
you mentioned the uniform.
I understand that, and so I'll address your question. What we believe was fraudulent were overpayments of salary and other monies to the control parties, Bowen Banbury and his wife Lana. There was no consideration to support those, and that they were actively and actually intended to denude the company of assets to the detriment of members. We contend that there were property transactions, for example.
And those were not decided by the trial court because
absolutely
of the summary
not
judgment.
No.
Yeah.
The judge found that we weren't members, we didn't have standing, and too bad.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please this court, I'm Franz Hardy, and along with me is Heather Kelly on behalf of the appellees, Bowen Banbury, Lana Banbury, and DocuBall Group, LLP. Briefly, I'd like to address five of the primary issues that were addressed by the trial court below. But in listening to Mr. Eason's comments, I think it's important that we do so in the context of the undisputed facts in the underlying case. I know the court is aware of many of these facts, but briefly, in 2003, there was an amended and restated operating agreement whereby Brooke and Mary Jo became Class B members. In exchange for becoming Class B members, and based upon their prior contributions, they received the 4% of Colorado gross receipts, which have been discussed at length. In essence, for no work performed, no responsibilities for the company, Brooke and Mary Jo Banbury received a distribution every single month from August 2003 through March 2008. The checks were sizable, as this court is aware, from anywhere from $10,000 a month to upwards of $30,000 a month. The payments, these monthly payments, could only end on two circumstances that are relevant to this court. One, default. Two, if a call option was made. The default, as this court recognized, meant that no further monthly payments would be available. If a default occurred, the Banburys would move from Class B membership to Class A membership. Therefore, they wouldn't receive a salary anymore, and the distributions would be up to the company. There was no economic...
You said salary. Are you sure? Is that what you meant?
Yes.
That Mr. and Mrs. Banbury... Salary?
No, Your Honor. If they became Class A members, they would not be entitled to a salary.
You're calling the gross receipts a salary? Is that what you're...
No, I'm not. I'm calling it...
Well, as Class B members, did they get a salary?
No, they received a monthly distribution. 4%
And what's the word salary got to do with that?
If they became Class A members, Your Honor, they did not receive that monthly payment.
That's different
they did
than
not
a salary.
Receive a salary. They would not receive a salary.
They never received a salary. Isn't that so? They got gross distributions.
You're correct.
Okay, go ahead.
And I didn't mean to confuse on that point. The point being, if they were Class A members, the monthly payment goes away.
Right.
The comment made by Mr. Eason that the door swings both ways has to be looked at in the context of the facts here. Only where the Banburys, and I mean Brooke and Mary Jo, not to confuse the point, but the Banburys learned of the impending sale of DocuBall Colorado for the substantial sum of $31.2 million, and thereby the monthly payments would go away because the call option would be provided for, did they raise the issue of a default back in 2006. The timing is, this is now April of 2008, the default that there occurred took place was in 2006. They had all the reasons in the world to assert a default at that point in time because they would not receive any monthly payments. Those are the undisputed facts.
Well, Mr. Hardy, is there anything in the amended and restated operating agreement that says they have to bring to the attention of the company the failure to pay a certain amount of money each month within a certain period of time?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I think if there's a default under the agreement, Justice Rivera, they have to bring that to the attention of the company. When the company continues to operate under a Class B membership status and continues to make monthly payments, that even the bank...
What article or provision of the operating agreement requires them to do it within a certain specific period of time?
Justice Rivera, I cannot cite a provision.
Yeah, I don't think you could, because I don't think there's one there. But go ahead.
In absence of being able to cite that provision, the Banburys have to tell DocuBall Colorado of the default.
When?
Unless, excuse me, Your Honor.
When do they have to tell them?
When it occurs, because...
Do they have any time, or how do they know this, that they're inadequate payments?
Well, I think we slip into a waiver argument if they know that they are not being paid accurately, but don't say anything, then they waive their rights. maybe not under the contract, but certainly under the law, and the law of the state of Colorado on labor.
Labor has to be knowing. Then we're getting a fact question. I thought you had arguments before that in terms of your argument was that underpayment does not trigger default, as I understood it. Before you get to waiver, I thought you were saying default talks about timing of a payment.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Because I think when you get to waiver, you're opening up a can of worms for yourself here with it depends on them knowing. And if they don't know, if they don't have an accounting, and they don't know they're systematically being paid, underpaid $1,000 a month, let's say, hypothetically, there's nothing from the waiver. They don't know they're being underpaid.
Well, the undisputed facts demonstrate that they knew that they were being underpaid. The arguments asserted by the Banburys are, well, they didn't know all the facts. They didn't know the precise amounts. They didn't know how that was being calculated. But you cannot turn a blind eye to their position that they were being underpaid, and they knew they were being underpaid.
When was that 2006 chart that they rely on created?
It was created for purposes of this litigation. And that's a big point that I'd like to emphasize and that Mr. Easton raised.
But as to waiver, how can they have waived something that didn't get created until after the litigation was filed?
Because they knew, Your Honor, that they were being underpaid because out-of-state proceeds were not included in the calculation of 4% of Colorado.
That's the Colorado receipts. Gross receipts.
Yes, Your Honor.
But in terms of the underpayment in 06, it doesn't depend on Colorado gross receipts. The company's admission, I think, isn't that an admission by the company that in fact you were underpaid in April and May, and then later in September and October? They didn't know about that accounting sheet, did they, at the time?
They didn't know about the accounting sheet, Your Honor. They knew that out-of-state proceeds were not being part of the calculation of 4% of Colorado gross receipts, and therefore that they were underpaid. So therefore, even though they might not have known,
you don't concede that you think that they were, that was properly excluded.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I'm addressing the waiver argument lightly, as the court is instructed. But certainly, you don't need to know the amount to understand that you can assert your right to default under the agreement.
Do you rely in any way on the de minimis argument?
I do rely on the de minimis argument. And certainly it goes
back to Mr. Easton takes that on head on and says that there's nothing in the agreement which requires for de minimis argument to be raised. Is he right or wrong?
I think he's wrong.
Okay.
And it was a point made a moment ago as to the reconciliation. The reconciliation was made as part of the underlying litigation. It did not exist in 2006. The important point to be made are the payments made monthly in 2006 to the Banburys were accurate of that at that time. The post-reconciliation that are now relied upon by the Banburys shows those de minimis amounts based upon maybe a small accounting differences, but in any event, don't demonstrate 3 months of untimely payments as required under the definition of default.
If you buy their argument that it's not enough to just pay that month, but you have to make up the shortfall plus 5%, then you do get the 3 consecutive months, don't you?
And we disagree with that. Yeah. The default talks about untimely payments. If a payment is made untimely, which they have not asserted, that's the only time where the 5% figure would come into place. There's no evidence of any untimely payments, nor have they asserted that.
So if you owe $10,000 to $30,000 a month, let's say you owe $20,000 that month, the company pays $1. No default? $1 for 3 consecutive months when they should have been paying $20,000 each month?
Yes. Under
yes,
the terms of the agreement,
no default.
That would technically be correct. But
would it be a default or not?
No, I'm sorry. It would not be a default because it does not fall under the technical definition of the term default.
Speaking of the door swinging both ways, if they want to rely on a technical interpretation of the agreement, then the agreement talks about timely payment, not accurate payment. Now, even to take one step into that, the payments were accurate when made. They're relying on a reconciliation for purposes of the litigation to demonstrate these marginal differences. The court also raised the issue of the call option, and I just briefly want to touch on that. The call option was properly raised. All that was required under 12.3 of the operating agreement was a delivery of a written notice. That was provided. That is undisputed that that information was provided to Brooke and Mary Jo's attorney.
And the written notice said that the company would be bound to retire, right?
It said that the company...
Under the agreement, it had to say that they were, quote, bound to retire.
No, I disagree with that, Your Honor. What the agreement said was that upon providing an election notice, the company is bound. The election notice doesn't say that the company has to be bound.
Okay.
But if you give the notice, you're bound.
And was the company bound? It was a conditional. It was if we sell, then we will pay, retire your interest.
When the company gave notice, it was bound to pay the $4 million, and it did.
It was bound on a condition that may or may not occur upon sale of the company. It wasn't that we'll buy you out, sale or no. It was that upon sale, we will you'll get $4 million from the sale.
Well, I believe by providing the election notice, the company bound itself to do that. It didn't matter whether it was conditional or required. It was bound, and it fulfilled its obligation. I think that addresses the Banbury's argument that this was somehow conditional. What the agreement says, if you provide notice, you're bound. You can't make conditional notice or absolute notice. You just provide notice, and if you do that, you're bound to follow through. And the company did.
And if you're right about that, then this affects the interests of the two Class A members not before us, that by paying money out of the sale closing price, the son increases his own ownership at the expense of the two members not before the court.
That's correct. That's exactly what the agreement says. That's the agreement that all of the members signed.
But that would not be the case if they were paid upon a winding down. Upon a winding down, the son would not benefit at the expense of the two other members.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor. My only hesitation is, to be honest, different provisions in the agreement don't come to the forefront, but I think the term of art is liquidating event. And ensuring that the election notice is provided before the liquidating event, because once the liquidating event occurs, you cannot do that. I believe that's accurate.
And isn't it fair construction of the agreement as a whole that their interest would have to be retired before a liquidating event? I mean, if you're retiring their interest as part of a liquidating event, doesn't that not seem to be a true retirement?
Well, I think what has to take place under the agreement is certainly to give the election notice, and that's what the agreement talks about, is providing that election notice that you are retiring their interest prior to the liquidating event, which took place.
Let me ask, if we held that there were questions of fact about whether they were properly retired as opposed to purchased or paid off upon a liquidated event, let me ask about how much they'd be entitled to as Class B members. They would be allocated $4 million, and after that, the allocations would stop. Is that correct?
Yes.
But their distribution would not necessarily be limited to $4 million. It would just be allocated to their capital account, and then there'd be a question of how much, if anything, was in their capital account before that allocation.
I believe the way the operating agreement is that the maximum is $4 million. That is the maximum they can be allocated.
Allocated.
Yes. That is the maximum. Now, not to slip too far into facts, but in 2003, when DocuBall Colorado was a fledgling business, $4 million was a figure that was something that the parties did not envision. But when the sale was $31.2 million, I think that's the context the court needs to understand, where the lawsuit was filed, and now the Banburys are trying to assert a class A interest over.
Well, I'm kind of on the Class B. I'm kind of on their alternative claim, I guess, at this point, jumping around here. But if they're Class B members, they're allocated $4 million upon the liquidated event, right? Or they're allocated the $4 million after Iron Mountain. Is that who purchased?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then that's not the maximum that they're entitled to upon distribution. It depends on what, if anything, they had in their capital account in addition to that allocated amount.
No, I think the maximum that they're entitled to is the $4 million. That is what that is, the maximum amount that they're entitled to receive, no matter the amount in their capital account. The capital account was taken into consideration when the 2003 amended and restated operating agreement was entered into.
How do you square that? I'm looking at 13.4. It talks about winding up, and it talks about how monies are, quote, applied and distributed upon winding up. And in paragraph C, subparagraph 13.4C, says after these other creditors or others are paid off, then the balance, if any, to members and transferees in accordance with their capital accounts, after giving effect to all contributions, distributions, and allocations. So I'm having trouble saying that $4 million is the cap on a distribution. Where does the agreement say that that's the allocation? I get that, but is an allocation different than distribution?
Well, I'm relying on the allocation. And to be honest, Your Honor, I know counsel for the company is not here, and I'm certainly not using that as an excuse, but a lot of those arguments were raised in their brief, and I am somewhat secondarily familiar. My understanding is that's the $4 million figure based upon their prior capital contributions, and that would be the total that they're entitled to.
And if we disagreed, is there a question of fact about how much their capital account prior to this allocation was? Isn't that at least a question of fact? Or is there undisputed evidence that their capital account was zero before the allocation?
I have to hesitate to attempt to answer that question, Your Honor. I apologize. I think it was something that's addressed more directly in DocuVault Colorado's brief. Again, I know that's not an excuse to answer the question.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Hardy, to follow up on Judge Conley's question. Let's assume for the moment that there's an unresolved material fact question of how much the Banbury, the parents, are entitled to. Has the trial judge ever ruled on that? And the answer is no, isn't that correct?
The trial judge ruled that they were entitled to $4 million in receipts.
But the claim by the Banburys, that the parents, that they were entitled to more than $4 million out of the sale, has never been ruled on by the trial court, is that correct?
I think the trial court did rule on that issue by deciding that they had received the $4 million allocation that they were entitled to.
Question of capital account, plus or minus, or whatever it might be, was never resolved to the trial court?
I think the trial court did address that, and the answer is
where?
That in its order that they received the $4 million.
I know that they received the $4 million, and that was part of the deal on the sale, was that the money would be, and everybody would agree that the money was paid and held in escrow. Is that correct?
That additional funds, based upon the ongoing dispute, would be held in escrow.
Well, my sense of the matter is that there is, I hesitate, but my sense is that there's a material facts which have not been resolved by the trial court, which leaves us in the position of trying to, I guess, the trial judge. And on this question of allocation, they got the $4 million. There's no just dispute about that. The question is, are they entitled to more? And what is that more? And the trial judge has not ruled on that, has he?
I think the trial court has, that the allocation of $4 million is all that they're entitled to under Class B interest. Now, not to be confused with the reserve account that was set up under the consent order, all that address, Justice Rivera, is to the extent that a determination was later made that they were Class A members, that money was set aside to address that. It certainly was not any sort of understanding or agreement that additional monies were owed to them as Class B members.
Well, Mr. Hardy, let's assume just for the moment that we determine that the trial court was right in saying they are Class B members. Is there anything left to be done?
No, I think this court could affirm summary judgment. The Banburys have received their $4 million.
I'll ask Mr. East that same question. I bet I get a different answer. But go ahead, please.
Well, there's more to be done. We have to get on to your arguments that they were either A, properly retired under the agreement, or B, that under the agreement they're only entitled to that $4 million, and that is the maximum of their distribution. I mean, it's still, analytically, there's more to be done, isn't it?
Well, I think the trial court has addressed that they're entitled to the $4 million.
By construing the agreement as a matter of law, not by making any, couldn't have made any factual determinations whether they had any pre-existing capital account.
Well, I think the contract takes into consideration the capital account in totaling the $4 million.
As a matter of contract construction. Let me, if you could, about 1615, I think you're on that one too. We didn't talk about that too often. The second appeal in which was brought by the son, I guess, for a declaration that the parents have defaulted and are no longer Class B members, even that they're, by bringing this suit, they default might be the wrong word. What's the word? That they, is it a default?
That they're a breaching member.
They're a breaching member. Can you tell me, what are the practical consequences of that? They still get there, even if that they'd be no longer a B member, they'd be a transferee of a B member. Is that what would have happened? In
the practical implications is when they filed their motion for temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction, they cease being a member of the organization, whether Class A or Class B, and arguably wouldn't even be entitled to the $4 million they thereafter received.
Well, that's what I thought under the agreement they'd be a, quote, transferee, that they'd still get their money, wouldn't they?
No, I believe, Your Honor, under 10.3 of the agreement, if you breach 10.2 by demanding the return of such members' contributions, excuse me, I said that inartfully. Under 10.2 of the agreement, if the member demands a return of his or her contributions, under 10.3, if a member takes any action in breach of 10.2, the breaching member shall immediately cease to be a member.
Your argument is you're not relying on that to say that they now, or are you? You're relying on that to say that pay us back the $4 million, pay Sun back, or pay company back the $4 million you've received. I think you already agreed that they were entitled to receive $4 million.
Well, certainly we're making arguments in the alternative, and that is an alternative argument by filing that and demanding something that you cannot do under the agreement. That is a breach. And the contract says you're no longer a member upon breaching the agreement, which would have been filing of the motion.
So the son got a declaration in his favor that the parents had breached, and you're saying that the result of that is that where does that lead? That's a final judgment, and is that entitled the son to return a $4 million? It does. It's a judgment for son, then?
Yes. And Your Honor, certainly we're making these arguments in the alternative. But yes, under 10.2, as harsh of a provision as it is, that's what it states.
What you really want us to do is say this. That even though that under the articles of the amended restatement, which is 10.2, what we have to do then is to say that the mere fact that the parents filed a claim, even though it might be justifiable and right, the mere fact of filing a claim devoids, lets them lose membership in the company. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And here's why. The provision is...
Even if they're right, and the son has... Let us assume for the moment that the son has committed theft and the parents file a lawsuit. The mere fact that they're filing a lawsuit makes them lose their membership, even if the son did commit theft.
No, that's the difference.
Come on, what are you telling me?
Yeah, that's the difference between 15.13 of the agreement that allows, that's been raised by the Bambers, that allows injunctive relief generally, in section 10.2 of the agreement.
But that's an injunctive relief. What if he files a claim claiming that the son is, or that the other party, I don't mean to cast aspersions on the son, but that the other party has committed fraud or and doesn't seek injunction? Are you saying that in that event, that the mere fact of filing that claim, even if they could prove it, is enough to lose them?
No. 10.2 addresses when a member demands return of such members' contributions.
Section 10.2 states that each member agreed not, and I quote now, to demand a return of such members' contributions or profits, or a bond or other security for the return of such contributions or profits, without the unanimous consent of the members. So let's take my hypothetical again. He loses membership in the organization if he files a lawsuit claiming that the son or the other party committed fraudulent acts and can prove it.
No, that's what 10.2 is specific. What you cannot do is demand a return of your contribution. What you can do is file a lawsuit for fraud, Justice Rivera, and that's the distinction.
And part of the relief when you file for fraud is you're claiming the return of your money that was taken by fraud, isn't it? Aren't you?
Well, if you do that, then I think you might fall under 10.2 under your hypothetical.
Okay. All right. And you want us to adopt that as the law of Colorado?
What our position is that's the language in the agreement. The purpose for having 10.2 is at the beginning, and I know that this company was not at the beginning stage when it was sold, and I'll take us to that point, but you cannot have members make contributions to start a company and take it out when they feel like it, because you're going to ruin the company. That's the reason we have 10.2. To fast forward into this particular context, what you cannot have are members demanding return of their capital when there's an impending sale, because what might happen is you might ruin the sale. So that's why 10.2 is in place, and that's why it's enforceable in this particular situation.
I don't want to delay this matter any further, but what you're just saying, the mere fact of filing the lawsuit is enough to make the parents lose their membership in the company.
No. The mere fact that you would file a lawsuit where you demand a return of such members' contributions or a bond or other security for the return of such contribution would, under 10.3, make the breaching member immediately cease to be a member under the terms of the contract.
As a lawyer who's argued waiver on the other side, why isn't there a very strong waiver argument, at least one that raises the tribal issue of fact, about whether the son, by not asserting this alleged breach and instead agreeing to a procedure where the parents were paid $4 million off the top of the sale, and or allegedly actually their interests were retired, according to you, why is that not a waiver with full knowledge of the facts that you waived this alleged breach and in fact allegedly retired their interests rather than taking the position that they're no longer members?
There's no waiver of that right. Simply taking the position or making the payment does not translate to a waiver of a breach under 10.2. There is nothing in the record, there is no statement that's been made by Mr. Banbury or his counsel that said we are not asserting a claim under 10.2, or there's never been a breach under 10.2.
Oh, but a waiver can be, as a matter of law, it's settled in Colorado, can be with knowledge of the alleged breach, taking action inconsistent with an assertion of your position. And if your position was that by the mere filing of the lawsuit of seeking return of capital, they are no longer Class B members, for you and the company, I think you've got to carry the company's water here too, I think, you and the company to not make that claim, but to the contrary, retire their Class B membership interests allegedly, seems to be action inconsistent with the position you're now taking, is it not?
No, it is not inconsistent. Certainly, you can make claims in the alternative. I think the timing is important, Your Honor. We filed a counterclaim alleging breach of 10.2. There's not this duration of time.
After they were paid their $4 million, that counterclaim?
It was after a consent order was entered into for the $4 million, but certainly the claim was preserved, raised, and asserted.
Raised after the allegedly inconsistent action, no?
The right has to be, the right that was not ever raised or waived, it cannot be waived, is 10.2. Statements regarding alternative positions on Class B membership is not enough or sufficient as a matter of law on the waiver issue as to 10.2 and potential violation of 10.2.
Council, I see you're out of time.
Thank you very much.
You have just over 11 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to focus on four areas. First, this question of default. I think we have the different positions outlined pretty well, but let me just see if I can restate them and argue as best I can for why our position is correct. A default is any failure by the company to make timely distributions under Section 4.1 for three consecutive months. Any failure to make timely distributions under 4.1. 4.1 says that except under Section 13.4, which is liquidation, 4% of Colorado gross receipts shall be distributed to Class B by the 15th day after the end of each calendar month. And if monthly distributions are not timely made, distributions for that month are increased by 5% of the amount that should have been distributed and added to the required distributions, and distributions are applied to the earliest month for which a distribution is owing. Now, we read the default provision to say, look, there's undoubtedly a timeliness requirement here. But if you don't also consider the substantive requirements of 4.1, then you have what we consider to be an unfair and absurd result where, as was pointed out, you can pay $1 each month on the 15th day of the month and you're never in default. What happens then? Well, first of all, the preferred remedy for default, conversion to Class A, is wiped out. Virtually impossible to have conversion to Class A. Two, management can play games with the revenues of the company to its heart's content. And three, most importantly, Vaughn Banbury, the manager of the company, can keep his right to redeem in place, to use the company's money to redeem, to take the interest that he's redeemed onto his own account, and to use that money to the detriment of the other members. Now, in this case, $4 million, the other members are 20% of the company. They pay $800,000 if there's a redemption, which we, of course, say there is not. But that's what would happen. Now, that's the ridiculous consequence. I think there's no other way to put it that you get with this timeliness obsession and saying it's only a matter of timing. Everything else doesn't matter. We say, yes, it's a matter of timing. That's essential. But the other elements of 4.1 have to be regarded as well. And if you don't comply with them, you are in default. Now, ironically here, the
long and short of what you're saying is it's not only timely, but it's got to be accurate.
That's correct.
I want to just say that and move on to the next.
I agreed with that.
Could you move on to your next point?
Okay. My point is the court below agreed with that. The court didn't take the extreme position that there had to be no payment at all. All right. So we say that's how you have to view default. Now, Colorado gross receipts. We say you have to view all company receipts as Colorado gross receipts. There are no non-Colorado gross receipts. And if you view it that way, there is no real reason to try to import a de minimis limitation into this agreement.
Explore your premise of all Colorado gross receipts. Aren't you, what's the purpose of the modifier Colorado in that case? Why might I just say gross receipts is gross receipts is gross receipts?
You could have said that.
Well, don't we assume that words have meaning?
The modifier is there to emphasize the fact that this is a Colorado company.
How do you know that? Is there something in the agreement?
That's what emerges from the text, as far as I can tell.
What emerges from that argument is that it's surplus. Colorado really adds nothing to the term gross receipts.
You could say that it does not differentiate between a certain type of gross receipt and another one. But I would suggest that you can read the agreement as long as you want. There is simply no construction that you can come up with which allows the company to have non-Colorado receipts. And the proof of that is that net cash from operations, which is defined as Colorado gross cash with certain deductions, is the cash that goes to the members. if there is non-Colorado cash, it doesn't go to the members. And the agreement says it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't say it goes to management. It doesn't say it goes to charity. It doesn't say anything. It's totally silent. So you have the ridiculous result that you would have non-Colorado receipts coming into the company, but no distribution to the members. The agreement simply can't be understood that way. Now, with respect to the issue of redemption, I don't think much time needs to be consumed here. It's obvious that even if you overlook the patently conditional nature of the notice that was given, which is, we'll buy it if we sell, it's obvious that the remaining provisions of 12.3 were not satisfied. Most importantly, the company continued to sue Mr. Banbury for a company-related debt after it purported, or says now that it purported, to redeem his interests. That simply can't occur under Section 12.3 of the agreement, which requires the company to assume all company-related liabilities of the retired person. And obviously that makes sense. If you're out, you're out. If you're no longer a member, you're no longer a member. You can't be out as a member, but in as a guarantor of the company's debt, or in as somebody primarily obligated for the company's debt. That is, that makes a hash of retirement and redemption, and that alone means that you cannot have had a redemption here. And because you cannot have had a redemption here, you cannot be limited to $4 million. This is why the gain provision comes in through the back door. I think the court realized, and I think the other side realized, that they were running up against a brick wall with retirement, that there were too many problems with arguing it, not the least of which is that the agreement under which the Banburys received the $4 million says nothing about retirement, was the product of litigation, was the product of negotiation, was not the product of any sort of closing of a call option. I mean, there's no facts to support that. So where do we go? We go to Section 3.3J and we say, oh, there's $4 million there. But as the court has pointed out, that's allocation. That's allocation to capital. It's not the same thing as what you receive from the proceeds of sale. So we do not believe that there's any way to sustain a determination here that there's been a retirement. We think the real question before the court in this appeal is whether we have A interest owners, or whether there's a material fact as to whether we have A interest owners, or whether we have B interest owners. In either case, the case has to go back for the adjudication of the remaining Banbury claims and for a determination of what they're owed out of the liquidation of the company. Now, just a brief comment on the waiver issue. I think the court is correct that this is just a can of worms and that there is no way that the facts on this record establish waiver as a matter of law. There is clearly a triable issue there. We concede that. But for example, the 2006 underpayments, it's admitted there's no way the Banburys could have known about that because they were not revealed to them, at least to the Banburys, until the lawsuit was filed. And we got the compilation that counsel discussed and that I discussed earlier. How could you have a knowing waiver in that circumstance? It's not possible. The out-of-state issue, we think there's ample evidence that this was a matter of debate and discussion back and forth between Brooke Banbury and his son Bowen, and we would urge the court not to lose sight of the fact that this was a family relationship. It was not only fiduciary, but it was familial. And there were problems. There was antagonism. There were problems. The Banburys couldn't see their grandchildren.
I don't mean to. Just got a few minutes left, and I want to talk about if you would Class A membership.
Well, if the court determines that either it's clear as a matter of law that Banbury is converted to Class A and there's a triable issue perhaps as a waiver, that's what we try in the trial court, or there's a triable issue on both points. If they converted to Class A, their share of the capital gain allocation from the sale is higher, and their share of the sale proceeds is higher. That's obvious. They will have to account for B distributions that were made to them in the accounting phase of the case post-conversion. That's clear. It's never been contested. If they're B members, on the other hand, and the court determines as a matter of law here that there's no way that they could have converted to A members, or we think even more dubiously that it's clear as a matter of law that they waived any such conversion, then they are still B members, and they are still entitled to assert injury as B members because they're entitled to recover from the proceeds of liquidation in accordance with their capital account. Therefore, there has to be an accounting.
There has to be a hearing in front of the trial judge.
That's correct.
On that theory, to determine what they're entitled to out of the sale
right.
of this company.
That's right. Now, to get
can you address also the, before you sit down, I know you've spent most of your time on 1614. Yeah. Can you just respond to what are the consequences, as you see it, to the declaration in 1615 that the district court granted to the son?
We think it's clear under Section 10.3, and in fact, Section 10.3E, that the cessation of membership means that you no longer can act as a member. You can no longer bind the company to the extent you had any authority to do so. But you're treated as a non-permitted transferee or an unadmitted transferee, which means you're basically reduced to an economic interest. We don't think it's ever even possible to go there. Because we think that, number one, 10.2 is focused on the circumstance involving the company operating and not in the brink of liquidation. Number two, it simply cannot be understood to prohibit a member from going to court and seeking to restrain distributions in liquidation, not to get their capital back, not to have the company post a bond.
No, I understand your arguments on the merits, and I think they're well set out in the briefs. My question was really more consequences, and that's perhaps why you haven't spent a lot of time on it, because you don't think it's particularly significant. Is that your position?
The court has to treat them, if that holding is sustained, and I can't imagine how, but if it is, they have to be treated as economic interest owners, and they're treated essentially in liquidation the same way. They still have a capital account, and they still have to be paid in accordance with their capital.
Bottom line, you should win, in your view, but you don't think a loss is that consequential?
Obviously, we think we should win, and I cannot say, because we didn't develop this further, whether there might be some tax consequences or other consequences. So I can't say certainly it's not a moot point, and one which we take very seriously. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes the oral arguments for this docket. The court will be in recess.